I use AI every single day, but I never go to OpenAI or Claude or any of those websites because Raycast is my portal to AI. It's a quick keyboard shortcut away, which means it's always at my fingertips. I can add attachments and build really powerful presets to streamline my workflows. And it's a big reason why Raycast has really quickly become the cornerstone of how I use my computer. So if you haven't tried it yet, do yourself a favor and head to dive.club/Raycast to get started. That's R-A-Y-C-A-S-T. Okay, now on to the episode.
Kind of work that other designers were doing that I wanted to emulate was in proposing ideas. Like the stage at which they got involved was, this thing doesn't yet exist other than being like some unstable idea in their own mind or in many people's minds, just no one had really put pixels to paper yet. There's no momentum to like drive it forward. There's no appetite in the company to like prioritize it. These designers would be able to create that momentum, get the project prioritized. That's the kind of work that I think a staff designer does at GitHub.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is with Kathy Zhang, who's currently the head of design at a Web3 protocol called Optimism. But before that, she was the first designer at Patreon and then went on to spend over 6 years at GitHub. So a big goal of this conversation is to look at how Kathy grew as a designer at GitHub, and specifically to analyze some of the milestones that she reached to help her get promoted to senior and eventually staff designer. So let's start this conversation by zooming in on the beginning of her GitHub journey.
By the time I was on my way out from Patreon, another designer had joined, really, really great designer. His name is Scott Takahashi. I didn't work with him too much before I had decided to leave. And so when I went to GitHub, I was really, really keen to find a team with other designers that I could learn from because I recognize I just was in way over my head at Patreon. They needed like somebody with way more experience to lead them through their early design. So at GitHub, I think that when I joined, my mindset was already, I want to learn as much as possible. I know I'm joining a team with really, really experienced designers. Most of them had been there for several years. So not only did they have a lot of design experience in any context, but they also had a lot of deep context for GitHub. And I think the first thing I noticed was the style of communication. This is because GitHub uses GitHub to build GitHub. And so all conversations, there was a lot of great discussion and asynchronous context that you could find in GitHub issues. And so I was able to not just see like what was happening in the moment on the projects that I was responsible for, but I could go way back in history and see the way people were talking about certain features or certain ideas years ago. So I was taking note of how people approached discussions in design. And also it allowed me to build an early sense of what kind of things led to conversational spin out and like no decision would get made because the problem itself is like really ambiguous and hard. It also allowed me to see how everyone just didn't really have an ego. Like it was really purely about the idea and about the work and about the problem, which was really great. And maybe I took particular note of that because when I joined GitHub, I would say it was like my second year in my career as a designer. Still had a lot of like insecurity around my work. And I think with insecurity, it obviously has to do with ego, right? And so that was one of the first things I noticed. And I saw very early on, in order to be successful here, I have to develop my communication style, the way I walk through ideas. And I also got like direct mentorship that, you know, told me, you know, this is a skill you should focus on. Here are some people who are really great at it that you can observe and emulate.
I like the phrase conversational spin out. What can you do as a designer to combat that and prevent it from happening?
A lot of the spin out was on things that were like not actually officially prioritized. An example that I like to fall back on because it's such a juicy topic, but because it also would come up so frequently in the history of GitHub is the contribution graph. Not only was there internal conversational spin out about, you know, what to do about that graph and how to improve it and should we like keep it or hide it or give people more options around it, there's also public spin out about it. Like people have very strong feelings about it. And so I think that largely it was spin out because it wasn't really a thing that had ownership. There wasn't anyone really responsible for making any decision on how to evolve that piece of UI and to like be responsible for developing strong opinions about that UI and how you would approach any of the potential directions you could go with. And so kind of things happen extremely slowly, like even for like GitHub's pace on product development at the time, which I would say was like a bit slower, much slower than it is now. And as I work through projects at Optimism, I think that when you see lack of progress on things that are getting deep discussion, it's really just having somebody who is responsible for moving it forward and driving to a decision, whatever that decision is. And so at GitHub, because conversations were so open and literally anyone internally could jump into a thread, yeah, lots of opinions were shared. And because there was no owner, these threads kind of petered out, but they became really, really great context for future design work. Like anyone visiting the GitHub profile, they would be reading all of this stuff and trying to understand like what their own opinion is on it, if they can move it forward.
I want to talk more about the ways that you grew during these 6 years at GitHub. And I think I want to do it by looking at the promotion moments, because like 2.5 years in, you were promoted to senior designer. And then again, you're promoted 2 years later to staff designer. So can we put those two moments under the microscope for a second? And maybe we can start with that first promotion. What were some of the developmental boxes that you think that you checked in order to earn that promotion to senior after 2.5 years at the company and 5-ish years designing?
So the senior promo, I definitely wanted that. Like I wanted it so badly. I think to me, it was what I thought success was, or what I believe success was to me at the time, was having that title. And it wasn't just because I wanted to reach that title. When I started to actually ask for a promotion and to talk about it explicitly with my manager, it was because I was taking on so much work. And so I think really the way the conversation started was from me saying, hey, I'm like owning multiple projects in parallel. I'm obviously like relative to other designers here taking on more ownership. And it's obvious that I'm trusted to be doing this. It seems really unfair to me that like we are all equal in terms of our title and position within the company. So that was like the framing of that first promotion. And my manager was like, you're not ready. And I was like very, very angry. And I think in retrospect, he was probably right. Maybe there was a gap between what I thought senior meant and what he believed senior was.
When you were kind of looking to be able to make this jump and get this promotion, and you seemingly wanted to like invest more of your time and effort into kind of proving yourself, how are you even thinking about the ways to make a bigger impact or where you could move the needle or take on more work? Like from that point of, I want to do a little bit more to justify this, how did you think about those next steps?
I think that this is where my observation of designers at the company who I knew were more senior than I was, like what they were doing and the kind of work they were taking on and the impact they were having. And I think the major delta between what I was doing before my senior promo or even staff promo and what I saw from other more experienced designers was, by the time I owned a project, there was pretty solid product thinking and design vision around it. I would pretty much be the executioner, like taking something that already existed, taking it to the next level, or like helping it actually become real through more low level design. And it was just that I was doing this for multiple projects. So in my mind, I was like, I'm doing a lot. I deserve a promo. That's what senior means to me, is just like, how much work can you own? Because that creates, the more work you own, the more impact you have. I think that was the way that I saw it. The kind of work that other designers were doing that I wanted to emulate, like I think I saw over time that the kind of impact they had was in proposing ideas. Like the stage at which they got involved was, this thing doesn't yet exist other than being some unstable idea in their own mind or in many people's minds, just no one had really put pixels to paper yet. And so when we talk about that idea, many people are imagining different things and they don't know how to drive it forward, or there's no momentum to like drive it forward. There's no appetite in the company to like prioritize it. These designers would be able to create that momentum, get the project prioritized, which would then potentially create multiple work streams in order to, you know, make that idea real. That's the kind of work that I think a staff designer does at GitHub. I think that I was like building that awareness over time. And I think, yeah, by the time I was staff, that was the kind of work I was doing more of, which would be, I inherit like that unstable idea. And then I start doing the work that maybe the senior version of me would have then taken on to make it real and actually execute.
Can you talk a little bit more about that moment where you get the unstable idea? Like, what are some of the ways that you are collapsing complexity even in your own mind to figure out what those next steps could be and chart a path to get momentum internally?
So when I receive the seed of an idea, it varies. Sometimes it's like a napkin sketch from my head of design. Sometimes it's like just a conversation with head of design, and he might tell me, can you put together a proposal or pitch for this idea? We're not sure yet if we want to like work on it, but we need to have something to react to. We need to drive alignment with various cross functions. At that time, this was probably 3 or 4 years into my time at GitHub. My experience was that the early energy for an idea was like extremely important. You really had to put that idea in front of the right people to make sure it just doesn't get trampled before it has a chance to even grow and become something real. And so the way that you navigate the org was really important. I think that's obviously as you level up and get more senior, I think what most folks will agree with is that your work becomes way more about soft skills and navigating people than it is about the work itself a lot of the time. What I saw was, okay, in order to convince person A and person B, here's the kind of work I need to put in so that they are aligned with me or aligned with the idea or bought in, and then they can escalate to whatever, CEO or whatever. I think with each idea, it was always about first understanding is there a problem? And if not, is there an opportunity that we're missing? How can I add some shape to that opportunity so that I can then take it to the people who will help put in even more nurturing energy into this idea, give it a chance to become real? It just came down to storytelling and figuring out the right framing as you spoke to different people. Some people really cared about metrics and qualitative anecdotes from users. Some people really cared about the perfect pixel view of that potential product. The most helpful insight that I received from my head of design, Max Schoening, was this analogy he gave me, which I still like to bring up to my own team, which is people are very different. They all see different sides of a Rubik's Cube. You have to learn which side to show them so that they realize that when you're talking about an idea, you're actually talking about the same thing. And design is the way to do that. Design is the way to clarify to everyone, this is what we're talking about. This is what we want to enable. To get to staff at GitHub, it took me really understanding that and going through that process a few times with different products. It's now like my opinion on like what a staff is to be able to take an idea, grow it, figure out how to navigate the org autonomously to give that idea a chance so that you can make business impact.
I love that analogy. I haven't heard that before.
You should talk to him. Yeah. I still look up to him, and I joke with people that I want to become a mini Max. Like, that's my goal as a leader.
Okay, so let's talk about the sides of the Rubik's Cube then. If your task is to shape an opportunity, what do those different sides look like potentially? You know, there's just many different versions. Some people might want it in writing. Some people might want prototypes, data. Like, how do you as the designer go from, okay, I think this person wants to see this side. What is the artifact that then you are going to make?
So I think that a lot of the kind of design proposals that I would make, they usually started with me trying to find some user anecdotes to lean on. All of my design proposals ended up starting with, here's some user context, just so let's like humanize this a little bit, help people understand that we are talking about real user experiences / opportunities. So this is what person A is saying about this experience. It's like super, super hard to track work within GitHub to size problems. And then you just hit them with like a screen next, you know, a design mock immediately next, like, what if this was the way things worked? And the design details of all of these things, extremely fuzzy. It was more about creating empathy for the problem or opportunity and showing like there is a way we could explore solving it. Because the goal with these proposals wasn't to say, you know, we should ship this. It was just to create enough buy-in so that there is appetite to even explore the problem and arrive at a very specific solution. But you do need to paint some idea of a potential solution, I think, to create that appetite. Because there's many, many different problems and many user quotes that you can throw at people. I think pairing it with a very explicit mock of how you might create a new opportunity or product vertical was always really impactful. I think that the the times in which these proposals were most convincing is when you start with a very specific problem that you're solving, and then you keep building on top of how it can create more and more impact across the product. Because GitHub is a pretty vast product, like it has a lot of surface area. And it was really fun to show, for example, this was a product that Brian Lovin and I collaborated on. The feature itself is like really simple, and I still hope that GitHub takes advantage of the potential here. But the product was like just being able to bookmark a repository. All repos, you have the star functionality, and it's really, people use it both to bookmark things, but they also use it as a social signal to say like, I like this project. So Brian and I were like, we should make a feature where it's explicitly bookmarking the things so we can separate, we can disambiguate what's a social signal and what's like people wanting to return to this project. Like that's valuable. We could have just stopped there. That's like the very specific problem that we could have solved. But we wanted to build on top of that to like show the whole world that could be enabled through that small feature. And so the next step was, okay, if people are able to create custom lists of repositories that they want to return to, you can now use that list to create feeds. This GitHub dashboard space, the homepage of the logged in experience. Not super useful. Probably most people don't use it. I don't know if that's still true now. But if you wanted to be able to allow developers to create custom feeds for themselves really quickly, you can lean on this pattern of the custom lists that they've created. And then if you want people to be able to become thought leaders within the social sphere of the GitHub experience, you can make it possible for people to subscribe to these feeds that were generated. And so you start to like paint this vision of like how this one feature can enable so much surface area change and create impact in other parts of GitHub that are front and center. That was one of my favorite like proposals to walk through because I was really bought into that world. But yeah, it was always like this kind of steady drip of increasing the surface area of impact, because I think that's exciting for people who are interested in product and business. But you're also pulling in various product owners, those that might own the different surfaces that you're talking about, and showing them this potential for improvement that would be beneficial to their objectives as well. And so you create more potential for more people to buy in and support this thing because they see how it can benefit their work. Ultimately, what makes all of this like fail or go slowly is just you do need to maintain like momentum, and there are people who are really good at doing that. And in order to maintain momentum, you got to get that product to a place where it is important enough to keep investing in. Otherwise, it will die pretty quickly once the initial seeders of the idea like leave the project. So that tended to happen a lot too, is like you'd have like one or two people who are really the soul of that project and really understand the vision and know how to navigate the org to create momentum. And if you lose that person, a lot of the forward movement dies out, and a lot of the change becomes way more incremental because GitHub is really big. There's a lot of things that can be worked on. And if your thing isn't necessarily the bottom line metric mover, then yeah, it's going to get reprioritized.
I feel that. Like I have a long list even as you're talking of just projects where I'm like, I specifically identified a feature as a building block because it unlocked other, you know, avenues that we could explore, and just nothing happened. And I think that's like, it's a tough thing. It's really difficult to continue momentum past the initial, you know, here's the P0 line.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's like another skill. I didn't exactly focus on it at GitHub, and I don't know if I'm actually focused on it right now. And as we're talking, I'm like, I should actually focus on this, which is like, How can you like help someone inherit all of that vision and your own ability to navigate the org dynamics and create buy-in? Like, that's a really useful skill and competency for designers to have if they don't want to just be an executioner. And I never tried to do that. I never tried to help another designer or PM even inherit my vision of like why this building block matters and how you should sequence work to get to this future state. But yeah, as a leader, I realized like that's what I should be doing with my own team, is help them inherit ideas and inherit the competencies required to continue to accrue energy and appetite for that product.
I want to talk to a very specific listener right now, someone who is in this very downstream execution role. They're listening to you and they're like, man, I want to have more of an impact in my org. There's just not space right now for these conversations. There's not a track record of proposing ideas. Like, I kind of just wait for that next PRD. They're going to open up their laptop on Monday morning. What are some action items that they can take to get some momentum and start taking steps towards higher level impact at the company?
Oh man, that's a really good question. The first thing I would do, if I knew that there was a thing I really believed in, I think it has to start there. Like, there has to be something that you actually believe would be valuable. It can't just be, I want to be working on more forward-looking things. Like, if that energy already doesn't exist, then you have to start it and you have to actually understand what you're trying to drive towards. You can't just drive towards it abstractly. So you would identify, you know, what's one thing that you might want to push forward that you think would be really valuable and you want more people to understand that value. I think that the initial upfront work would be that you paint that vision through designs or prototypes, and then you just start sharing them in Slack. You probably would want to identify the people that you think could be really great allies in buying into that thing and escalating it. Because ultimately, in order for prioritization to happen, you need that idea to reach somebody who has that power and influence, if it's not yourself or your team. And you build that relationship with that person and offer yourself as a tool and resource to paint that future and show, like, hey, you know, I'm underutilized. This is what I would be able to do if we partnered and paired, or if there was space. The tricky thing is if there isn't already space for you to be doing that work in your work time. Like, I don't know, I spend a lot of my personal hours doing that kind of work because I was interested and passionate about it. I really wanted to please my boss. and yeah, I would spend evenings like jamming on a design vision thing that I understood may or may never happen. If I didn't do it, then it's definitely true that it will never happen. And so, yeah, it's not the greatest answer, but it's like the reality. Like, I think you do have to find your foot in the door. And that involves both taking on one opportunity or problem that you really believe in, that you can actually design around and create a story around, because people will understand it better through a story and through a visual. And then you have to find like a couple people that you think you can lean on to help proliferate that story and add more fidelity to that story so that there's a possibility of it being prioritized by leadership or whoever is responsible for creating space and funding for a project.
Yeah, it reminds me of something. I think it was Steph Engel from Snap who told me, but the value of maybe even as a first step sharing like a prototype or whatever you have with someone just to get initial feedback, make them feel like they're a part of the ideation process so that when it is shared publicly, you have like a built-in advocate even.
Yeah, like maybe a very simple small thing you can do even before you mock anything up is think of the people you already work with and think of the people that have like a lot of hunger for creating. And it's very likely that there's a backlog in their mind of things that they want to exist that there just isn't time for yet, or it isn't being prioritized yet, or it probably will never happen because there's always other things to work on. If you find those people and you talk to them, like, what would be one thing, you know, on your wish list that we could do a small design sprint on to help make it real, and then create that partnership. And then you have this like ally who really feels invested in the thing too, because they want it to exist as well. And that's a really good point, because there's almost nothing that I worked on that was like purely just my own opinion. Like, it was always a shared opinion with at least one other person. And we would collab to figure out how to navigate it so that it has a chance of getting prioritized.
I love that advice. There's always a backlog in everyone's brains. Like, man, I wish we were doing this. And so, yeah, if you're listening and you don't have like the burning idea, just tap someone else. And I think that's fantastic advice.
Even better if you see that person is a megaphone. Like, there are those kind of people within a company that are just really, really great at proliferating and creating hype around a thing. You got to find those people.
So you talked about the mediums of communication, which reminded me of a little note that I jotted down that I heard you talk about, which is this moment where you realized that if you wanted to have a big impact at GitHub, you'd have to invest in writing. And specifically, you talk about opening up your colleague Kat Fukui's README and using that as like a guideline for how to communicate. So I have to know, what was she doing well and how did that contribute to your impact at GitHub?
What happened was In my first year, I joined GitHub around the same time as Kat. We joined the same month, and so we were kind of in the same progression in our career. And one day, my manager at the time, this was Connor Sears, he was like, "Oh, Kathy, you should look at this README that Kat wrote. You should look at this and like do this." And I was like, "Okay." So every time I worked on any project, I would open it and be like, "How did she frame it? Okay, she started with like some user anecdote. She immediately followed up with like the sketch of what could be possible, and then she like landed it with final design." It was pretty brief. It wasn't like a huge write-up or anything. And I just started framing everything that way, and it went really well. Also because there was a lot of appetite on cross-functional teams at that time to see that kind of thinking from design. Because I think in my experience, what tended to be true was that designers were just the best at framing the problem and opportunity, like relative to their product and engineering counterparts. And so the product and eng folks would like really eat it up and bring it, to their teams, and then the energy would be created. I think one good example of this that ended up becoming real was how GitHub Sponsors started. So that was a project that Kat was the design lead for that she took end to end. And the first initial doc was just like, okay, how do people set up funding to begin with? And the vehicle for it ended up being a YAML file that you initiate in your GitHub repo, and you write in like which repos and which users can have a sponsor button on their page. And it was very clear that this was like a building block for something bigger. So yeah, I think it was really simple. It wasn't super maybe practiced at GitHub at the time, like this way of framing ideas. Like she did a lot of sketching, very lo-fi stuff just to illustrate the user story. Not even the design like path. And I think that was a game changer, just like putting a little bit of effort into anchoring people to what users are experiencing, like their pain points, doing more than just taking a quote, doing more than a text version of that problem. Like she actually illustrated out, this is like the user comic of what they would experience, and yeah, and why this is important. And I started doing more of that. And I think the first reaction people had would be like, wow, this is so cute. Like, it's so awesome that there's these sketches. But then they would actually understand the story and it would stick with them. And so I think that user story would just stay very crisp in their minds when they actually looked at the design problem and opportunity. It's way more powerful than seeing a quote, but quotes are good too. It's better than not having anything for sure.
Something I did a couple years ago, kind of randomly, was I went into the Figma community and I was looking for like little doodle sketches that I could put into a deck. And I found these stick figures, and the stick figures did like a pretty good job of communicating emotion. I put them next to like the little blurbs of like what the user was saying, and people loved it. Like I had like multiple one-on-one DMs in Slack afterwards. I'd be like, where'd you get that library? That was so cool. And I've just started using it for everything now. It's just like little subtle ways that you can communicate the emotions and what a user is feeling rather than just like a screenshot, like you said, go a really long way.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's actually why memes are so great. They kind of distill down like the sentiment. They make it humorous. Like I think a lot of times our little comic sketches of user pain points would be humorous, but also like sad. Like you really want it to create empathy. And also we're people, so most people will retain information in a story format, right? Like they're gonna remember a story, not just like a fact. So the more you can make it a story, the more it can be this like stable context that people remember as they head into looking at a design. And the other thing is it gets referenced a lot. Me referencing Kat's README is one example, but then also like people will screenshot it and include it in other presentations when they're talking about a thing that is anchoring to the same problem or same user story. And then that thing just like proliferates. So I think illustrating out the user story, it's kind of like creating a comic or a meme that you can then just use in various contexts. And yeah, it's a great way to like qualify or contextualize something that might get missed otherwise, but it's really, really important in driving design forward.
I like comparing it to a meme because a lot of times the ultimate buy-in is not going to happen that very first time that you present the nugget of an idea. A lot of times you're really just equipping other people people to then go to bat on your behalf in subsequent conversations. And so thinking in terms of memes, how can I give these people memes to communicate my ideas succinctly? It's a really interesting metaphor.
When I was like creating designs and proposals around the GitHub user profile, I remember the first comic I made was this story that one of my peers who worked at GitHub told me, where she wears her GitHub hoodie and it's like this kind of common hoodie, like people who know GitHub, I think, have seen it. And hers had her handle, so people knew like, oh, she works at GitHub because it has her custom name on it. And she was on an airplane, had her laptop open, and she was like looking at her GitHub profile, because that's also how a lot of people go find their repos. And somebody passed her on the plane, and she said that they asked her, oh, do you work at GitHub? And she was like, yes. And then the person was like, oh, but your graph, it's like not very green. Like there's not enough commits on your contribution graph. And then she just felt so gutted. And also as like a woman, like probably as an engineer, like you already deal with people kind of questioning your experience. And then when you pair that with somebody judging you by your graph, it just feels so bad. So my comic just like told that story in three panels. And I like anchored the whole like, okay, here's like the problem with the contribution graph and the problem it creates in the community and why people are like so polarized on it. Yeah, I think, I don't know like how powerful it actually was, but it's an example of how to like condense that story into a format that maybe has the chance to meme itself.
Yeah, it's kind of a similar idea to even like giving concepts like actual titles, because it's just easy to remember them. I could see it, like what you're doing is making it really easy to refer back to what you're communicating. Like, yeah, it's the airplane story. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like your graph isn't great enough that it's that one.
Yeah. Let's zoom ahead in your story here and make a rather big conversational transition, because you made a pretty big career transition, literally going from Web 2 to Web 3. So can you talk a little bit about why you made that jump? But also, I would like to hear more about how you ramped up on a really, really different set of problems after spending such a long time at GitHub.
It's a really great question. And I was asking myself that as well. Like I was feeling for the first time in many years that sense of imposter syndrome that I kind of thought was behind me. And the imposter syndrome was totally anchored on, oh, I don't know anything about optimism. I don't know anything about Web3. I don't know what L2 means. The reason for the transition is like pretty simple. I was at GitHub for 6.5 years, really long time. And then I think around that time, I had worked on so many different projects and products that I knew that I would kind of be rinse and repeating this over time. I'm going to encounter the same problems. I'm going to return to the same surface areas. I'm going to talk about contribution graph again in a year, because we revisit it like every 2 years. And I just kind of knew like what my future would look like. But my day-to-day was pretty chill. And so I wasn't unhappy. I was really content. I didn't have the same level of energy and passion that I had in the first 5 years there. I think the sixth year I started to get to a place of complacency. And then I think all that happened was like a couple people who were in my org at GitHub left. And that added a lot more workload to me. I was like pseudo managing, I was still running projects, but a lot of the people that I worked with that were kind of the soul of that org had transitioned to other places, and new people were coming in and getting stable. And so it was a period of change for my context at GitHub, and my workload started to pile up. So I was getting like less and less happy because I didn't have the energy for it. And so I knew it was probably time for me to transition, but I didn't really know where to go. Like a lot of the things I just described around lack of interest, same old problems, revisiting the same areas, I kind of felt that same way in general in tech. And so I even entertained like maybe I'll just do pottery or something completely non-tech related. The reason I joined Optimism was that one of the people that I had worked with at GitHub on GitHub sponsors and GitHub discussions, he went to Optimism. And we happened to chat after that, and I was like really happy for him. I told him I was really gonna miss working with him, and I kind of just joked like maybe I'll follow you there, and he was like, well, that would actually be really nice. And then once I got unhappy at GitHub, I was like, actually, I'm just gonna do it. I'm ready for something new, and I feel like I'm ready for a startup. GitHub is like a really mature place, really, really great team. Like, I still highly recommend it as a place for designers. I just had accrued a lot of different skills that I wasn't always able to utilize there anymore because of the org structure, because it's mature, it's got a very robust design system that's not going to change dramatically, and there were clear areas of ownership for me. So I think I started to get excited at the possibility that I would be able to stretch myself in all the different skills that I knew I had. And I kind of was like, maybe it's my redemption arc from Patreon, where, I was way too inexperienced when I joined Patreon as the first designer, had no idea what I was doing. Now I know what I'm doing and I have real experience. I feel way more comfortable being an early designer at a company, even though I don't really understand the space yet. Because when I joined GitHub, I didn't know what Git was. So I knew I could deal with it. Like, I knew I would learn. And I think that that's all I really needed. I needed to get unhappy with my current situation. I needed to get some nudge towards like a potential direction, like just the possibility that it might be enjoyable. And that was like my friend joining this company that I knew I liked working with. And then three was like just the belief in myself that even though I don't know shit yet, I will develop that knowledge.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. Before we hit record, you were explaining to me how Web3 is so much more about collaboration. Can you talk a little bit about how that impacts the function of design? Like, what makes the design challenges that you're facing now unique to maybe what you were thinking about at GitHub or Patreon?
The difference is that in Web3, a lot of the impact you can have, I think, in design as a function is empowering communities outside of people who are, just employees of Optimism or whatever, empowering other communities, other teams to leverage design as a resource, whether it's like literal mocks, whether it's brand assets, or whether it's a way of thinking. In that way, it's a lot more collaborative. Not to say that Web2 isn't collaborative, it's just collaborative within like an inner source system. Whereas Web3 and Optimism, we think about working in the open, building together, empowering other teams to be successful so that the entire ecosystem is successful. It's very much if this space is successful, then we are successful. And so the way we think about funding and resources, funding being like anything from grants to actually creating energy and amplification for a team or product. I've never actually been a huge part of any open community. I've just designed for them at GitHub and at Optimism. But I think that my current stance is a lot of the most valuable work that design teams do is like the journey to get from end to end. The final output and like the pixel perfect stuff, of course, like that's what we end up using and interacting and thinking of, but the really valuable stuff is like in between. It's like all of the context that drove the design decisions that you see. And so I'm like, well, if that's my opinion on like what's valuable in design, then how do we open source our knowledge as a resource for communities so that more people can ramp up and learn and kind of inherit our ways of thinking or just have more context for why things are the way they are. I think a lot of that opinion was actually developed at my time at GitHub because I derived a lot of value from all the old conversational history I was able to explore for, why the contribution graph is the way it is and why it hasn't changed at all. How long it took for us to get from circle avatars to org avatars being square and user avatars being circle. Like these things being discoverable without any gatekeeping allows really passionate people to contribute and to contribute without naively overriding past decisions and past context, which I think is really vital for a successful asynchronous, remote, distributed system. You have to make that knowledge really, really easy to access, easy to understand, and easy to track. And so I think, you know, there's so much you can do with that, but I think the first stage is just literally extracting what might be valuable for the community and incrementally releasing it to see how it does, see how people use it, and then react and try to turn it into as much of a collaborative game as possible. Because design thinking tends to be like a very private resource, right? Like it's a tool for the company, not a tool for its community a lot of the time, but hoping to change that.
It's interesting to hear you compare where you're at now with, you know, the 24 or whatever year old version of yourself at Patreon, where you like have this total blank slate, so many different opportunities to make an impact. And, you know, a lot of times when you have that transition point, it's a moment where you can reflect and identify all the different ways that you've grown. So I'd like to toss a hypothetical your way. Knowing what you know now and being back in a somewhat similar environment, if you were to take on that like 24-ish year old version of yourself at Patreon, sole designer, working at this high growth startup, what's a piece of advice that you would give?
I think that's something I had really low self-esteem about at Patreon was just my actually, this is true at the beginning of each job. I just have different levels of confidence at different stages in my life. So I mentioned when I was interviewing at GitHub, I didn't know what Git was. I didn't know what pull requests were. And that was like the design exercise. At Patreon, I was like just graduated college, didn't know anything. And they were talking about creator economy. I didn't know what that meant. Our way of explaining Patreon was like, this is the Kickstarter, but like forever, subscriptional Kickstarter. I think what I would tell my younger self is once you believe in Jack Conte's vision, try to actually map it out visually, like create a visual story for where this, what this product can look like, what Patreon can look like that matches and pairs with his vision of the future. Because he was like the seed and soul of driving designs, like the kind of design decisions that we made at the time. I think he was really the ultimate stakeholder. I don't think I really saw it at that time because I didn't interact a lot with Jack at the project level, but he was such a charismatic figure. And I think that I would have told myself at that time, like, disregard the org structure or these titles. Like, you know that Jack Conte is providing all the energy for the vision of what it might look like for creators to be able to have a really close relationship with their community and to be empowered through their community instead of by like middleman or corporate entities. Help him visualize it. He already sees it. Help him visualize it in design, and then you can create more stability for the product roadmap. And I will be like, because hint, hint, your product roadmap is going to be very unstable and it's going to feel like you're getting thrashed all over the place quarter to quarter. Because that's what ultimately led to my burnout, was feeling like I wasn't able to really contribute and be impactful there. And at the time, I was naive and I was like, oh, this is because everything is bad and I have no control. But there were different ways to navigate it that I think would have made things go a lot better and maybe like prolong the period of time I spent there.
I'm going to restate it just so I have a solid understanding of what you're saying. So is it more about proactively visualizing ideas versus waiting for them to actually get put on the roadmap for execution?
Yeah, I think that that's a good way to simplify it, because I'm thinking about why I burnt out and why I became so unhappy there. And it was like a very typical problem, which is, you know, you're working on different things all the time. It's not clear how they tie together. It's not clear how you're having impact, and you want to have a good story, you know, throughout your time as a designer there. Designers tend to be so invested in their work and they really vibe with the values and mission of the company that they work at usually, I think, especially if you're younger. I'm trying to think about like, how could that story for me have gone better? And how could I have actually taken more ownership of that problem and influenced it? Because what I saw at the time was that, oh, I have no control over how the company chooses to prioritize, which problems are important. And I think that having a closer relationship to the CEO who has like so much product vision and using design as a tool to not just create like a vision of the future, but to align yourself to that vision, because I think that that would have been really valuable for me at that stage. Like, I was inheriting ideas, opinions, and everything from other people because I was young and was just learning. And getting more ownership over that vision and understanding what it actually looked like would have been helpful. And maybe there was a possibility that the roadmap is more stable, but I'm sure there were other things happening that I wasn't aware of. So I was just thinking, how can I solve for product instability or like product prioritization thrash? Which is you have to have some sense of where things are going and be invested in that. And when it's just words and all hands talks, like it's not stable enough. You need to give a lot of people something to look at. And so I guess it's like, if it's possible to jumpstart that worldview that I now have, that design is this alignment tool and a tool for creating energy that may be latent, I would want to pass that off to my 24-year-old self. It would be, I don't know, 3 years before I like inherited that opinion or earned that opinion at GitHub.
Last question. Let's bring it back to today. You talked about all the different ways that you're being stretched in this new role. What is an area of growth that you want to prioritize for the next year plus?
I think that what I'm going through right now in my career is like learning what kind of leader I am. Like, I don't think I've fully become that person yet. And I know that a lot of what I've learned so far about being a leader are very basic skills, like listening, like slowing down a little bit, listening, really developing a full perspective. Because I think that I came from a context where I had so much trust that I always came with really strong opinions and perceptions of what the reality was. And now in my leadership position where I'm responsible for more people and I'm responsible for being a caretaker of their ideas too, like actually slowing down to not just drive my own point of view forward, but to be way more open to what is happening on my team, but also happening on different functions. Like it's the first time I'm having a closer relationship with marketing and communication and business development functions. That tended to be more on the, you know, creative brand side of things that I never really touched at GitHub. And so I'm learning a lot about what those functions need in order to be successful, the role that design plays in that. And is that the same as, you know, the way that I navigated things in product design? I think that probably where I want to stretch the most is really developing a really good understanding of brand, because that is so different, I'm learning, than product design. The way that you move through work, really, really similar, but like the work itself and the value and the impact that it provides, like so much more intangible. And the path to get to like the final impact you want to have or the final outcome, it's like a very long game. And so I come from like very scrappy, very incremental progress type of world. And I think I'm learning that I need to slow down. So far, a lot of things that I'm learning are not the things that I thought I would be learning. I'm not really sure what I was imagining would be challenging for me as a leader. I think it was just a sense of responsibility. Like that's why I avoided it actively for so long. Like I just hate taking on responsibility. And I'm learning to really own that role and recognize where I have way more control and influence than I actually have. It kind of returns me back to this framing that I always really liked that I discovered a couple years ago now, this thing called rules versus laws. I think that basically the framing is laws are things that you actually can't change. Like example would be gravity. Rules are things that seem to apply to everyone, but you can actually break them. There's nothing actually stopping you from breaking them other than incentives. And so within an org, I think the rules would be like org structure. People kind of thinking, well, if I have a problem, doesn't make sense for me to go up to the CEO, right? That's probably not the first person I should talk to. But it's not actually a law. Like you can do that if you really felt compelled to. And so I think I'm trying to apply more of that framing to the way I navigate things. Yo, whatever it is that I need to do in order to help this project make a bigger impact or help my team be more successful, I just need to do it. I need to disregard these things that are assumed structures or assumed rules. I need to break out of that.
Kathy, thank you so much for coming on and I mean, really just sharing kind of everything about this journey and all the different ways that you're growing. And it's really been insightful to see that progression. It sounds like you're in a really exciting place now. Happy for you. And yeah, thanks again for taking the time.
Well, thank you. I feel so grateful to have been invited to come on and actually be asked these questions because it does help me develop an updated view of myself.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.